Imagine, if you will, like stepping into a boxing ring. You're standing across from an opponent whose sole objective is to just, you know, take your head off.
Which is a terrifying thought for most of us.
Exactly. Your heart's pounding. Your survival instincts are screaming at you to keep your distance. But what if I told you that in this ring, your defense, the very moves you use to avoid getting hit, is simultaneously your most lethal attack? Like, how is that even physically possible?
Well, I mean, it completely shatters the traditional binary we're taught about combat, right? Or really any competitive arena. We're so conditioned to think in these distinct, separate phases.
Right, like you defend and then you attack.
Exactly. You defend, you survive the onslaught, and then, you know, if you find an opening, you strike back. So the idea that slipping a punch and throwing a devastating knockout blow are the exact same mechanical action, it sounds like a physical paradox.
It really does. And that paradox is basically the beating heart of Customato's legendary fighting style. So in today's deep dive, we're unpacking the exact mechanics of a system that forged heavyweight champions like Mike Tyson and Floyd Patterson.
Oh, yeah. The heavy hitters.
Seriously.
Right.
We're using the book Non-Compromised Pendulum by Dr. Oleg Maltsev and Tom Patti. Tom Patti was actually a direct mentee of Customato, so we have incredible source material here.
Yeah, you really can't get much closer to the source than that.
Right. And we're looking specifically at Chapter 8, which lays out the highly guarded technical structure of this style. So no myths, no legends, just the pure terrifying physics of how this system works, starting right from the ground up.
Which is the only place to start, honestly.
Exactly. Because before a fighter can even think about dodging or striking, they have to stand. But the text notes that in D'Amato's system, the stance isn't just, you know, a resting posture. It's a highly engineered, active, tactical weapon.
Yeah, see, most people view a stance as a neutral starting point, like a place you retreat to when you aren't actively engaging. But the D'Amato corpus stance is built for constant, aggressive pressure.
It's intense.
Very. Let's look at the physical requirements the book outlines. The hands must be held rigidly at eye level, not guarding the chin, not protecting the ribs, but right at the eyes.
And the chin is tucked tightly into the chest.
Right.
Right? Which the source makes a point to emphasize isn't just a defensive tuck to protect the jaw.
No, not at all.
Keeping the chin glued to the chest is an active technical element used specifically when advancing on the opponent.
Right. Well, think about the biomechanics of the human body for a second. When you tuck your chin to your chest, you are actively locking the cervical vertebrae and changing the structural integrity of your entire spine.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about it like that.
Yeah. It rounds your shoulders and pushes your center of mass forward into an attacking posture. You essentially become a battering ram.
Which is terrifying to face, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Because if your head is upright, any impact will just snap your neck back. But by tucking the chin, any kinetic force directed at you is absorbed by the stronger muscles of the upper back and shoulders.
That makes total sense. And the center of gravity is meticulously managed here, too. The book details how this stance guarantees that both hands can punch at maximum power at any given millisecond.
Exactly. Power generation comes directly from the ground up. In the D'Amato stance, one hand always has a direct kinetic chain to the floor, like a solid support point.
Right.
The other hand might be loaded differently, but the stance is designed so that just a fractional turn of the hips or shoulders instantly creates a new support point for that second hand. You are never, ever off balance or reaching.
You're just always anchored to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to a rule that honestly completely blew my mind, because think about your own natural reflexes, right?
Right.
If something suddenly flies at your face, your immediate human instinct is to pull your head back. But the text highlights this radical, unbreakable rule in the system. You never, ever pull straight back on the direct line.
Never.
Reverse gear simply does not exist.
And there's a brilliant reason for that. D'Amato recognized a fundamental, basically fatal geometric flaw in moving backwards. Imagine your opponent throwing a straight right hand right down the center line.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you pull straight back, your head remains perfectly aligned on the trajectory of that punch. And the human arm, when it's snapping forward in a punch, will always travel faster and cover more distance than your entire body can step backward.
So you're basically just delaying the inevitable.
Worse than that. If you try to outrun a punch in reverse, it will catch you and it will knock you out because you're moving into its terminal velocity.
Oh, man. That is brutal. So the rule is you can only move forward or you can move sideways. And the footwork required to maintain this is incredibly strict.
It really is.
Like, if you want to move left, your left foot moves first and your right foot follows by exactly 6 inches.
moving right, the right foot leads and the left follows by 6 inches.
Yeah, and maintaining that coiled, forward-leaning center of gravity while stepping laterally is exhausting. To master this, fighters perform a relentless drill called the twist.
The twist, right.
You jump into the air, rotate your body, but you must land in the exact same stance with the exact same 50-50 balance instantly. It's about resetting your weapon platform in a fraction of a second.
Regardless of where your momentum was carrying you. But I have to push back on this a little, though.
Sure, go for it.
Let's put ourselves in the fighter's shoes. You're in the ring. A heavyweight is throwing absolute bombs at you, and you've taken away your own ability to step back and take a breath. Doesn't that feel incredibly claustrophobic?
Oh, 100%.
It sounds like you're locking yourself in a phone booth with a killer.
Mm-hmm. It feels like suicide until you introduce the geometry of the system. This is where the text specifically mentions the use of Spanish angles and the concepts of whipping and ducking. You aren't just standing chest to chest absorbing punishment.
Wait, let's clarify that real quick. What exactly is a Spanish angle in this context? Are we talking about stepping off the line of attack, almost like a matador sidestepping a charging bull?
That is a brilliant way to visualize it, actually. When a punch comes straight down the center, instead of moving back, you step at a sharp diagonal angle to the outside of their leading foot.
Okay.
So you are still moving forward, but you're slicing across their peripheral vision. By taking these short or long Spanish angles, you slip right past their offensive weapons.
Wow. So you're getting so close you can practically smell their sweat, but because you're constantly shifting off that center line, you become an absolute ghost.
Exactly.
You're sitting right in their blind spot, perfectly positioned to strike their unprotected ribs or jaw, while their punches are just, you know, sailing into empty space where you used to be a half second ago.
Which perfectly sets up the next crucial mechanic. You've used this aggressive forward angling stance to step right into the danger zone. You haven't taken a single step backward. Your feet are planted right in front of them.
Right in the pocket.
Right. So how do you survive the incoming fire now that you are in the pocket? This is the domain of D'Amato's core engine, the pendulum.
Yes. And we need to clear up a massive public misconception here, because when most people picture a cussed D'Amato fighter, usually Mike Tyson, they picture a guy just constantly bobbing and weaving his head in a giant U-shape from the moment the bell rang.
Like a metronome swinging back and forth.
Exactly, just constantly moving.
Yeah, the text is explicitly clear that doing the pendulum 2 meters away from an opponent is a complete waste of energy. The pendulum is not a nervous antic.
Right.
It's a highly calibrated defensive mechanism that only activates when the fighter's feet stop after they have successfully closed the distance. You march in, you plant your feet, the opponent throws a punch, and that is when the pendulum initiates to slip the strike.
The book mentions something fascinating about the variations of this movement, too. Apparently, there are 8 possible pendulum movements that exist in this overarching combat system.
Right, which would all be utilized in a chaotic, unpredictable street fight.
Yeah, but for the controlled environment of the boxing ring, D'Amato isolated and relied heavily on just 4.
Well, the ring is a restrictive environment, right? You've got ropes, a referee, rules against grabbing or kicking. Those 4 specific pendulum motions allow the fighter to shift their weight aggressively side to side, slipping punches by mere millimeters.
Wow.
It requires transferring your body weight from one leg to the other while maintaining that perfect chin-tucked, eye-level guard we talked about.
And this leads to my absolute favorite detail in the entire source material. The pendulum isn't just about hiding from a punch. The text uses the phrase rotation with a simultaneous punch.
Yeah.
When I read that, the image that immediately came to mind was a tightly coiled spring. You don't slip a punch, breathe a sigh of relief, pause, and then decide to throw a counter.
No, there's no time for that.
The physical act of evading the punch is the mechanism that loads your kinetic energy.
You are twisting the spring tighter with their own momentum. As the opponent throws a punch, they are extending their arm, exposing their side, and shifting their balance forward.
Okay.
As you use the pendulum to slip to the outside of that punch, all of your body weight loads onto one leg. Your hips are cocked, your shoulder is coiled.
The evasion is the loading phase of the weapon.
Exactly. By the time the opponent realizes they have punched thin air, they're overextended and completely vulnerable, and the D'Amato fighter is already fully loaded in the perfect geographic position to unleash that stored kinetic energy.
Man. Attack is literally equal to defense. You aren't separating the two. You're weaponizing their offensive momentum against them, catching them at the exact moment their balance is compromised.
It's brilliant. So we have the fighter slipping punches in the pocket, loading up massive amounts of kinetic energy on those Spanish angles. The natural question is, what are they actually firing back?
Which brings us to the striking matrix. The authors call it the 7+1 system. And compared to the infinite variety of martial arts, it is remarkably minimalist.
It really is. D'Amato analyzed decades of fight film. He stripped away the flash, the wasted motion, the low percentage strikes, and he distilled the entire sport down to just 7 foundational punches.
Just 7? That's wild.
Right. The text outlines 4 hooks, 2 uppercuts, and 2 straight blows. An 8th hit, a rare straight hand counter to the body, was incorporated later, but the core engine relies entirely on those fundamental 7.
So those 7 strikes are basically the alphabet. But the language comes from how you string them together. The text details how fighters drill these 7 punches so relentlessly that they can chain them together at blinding speeds,
creating endless combinations of 2 to 6 blows based purely on the openings the pendulum creates.
Wow.
It becomes a mathematical certainty. If an opponent drops their left hand, the fighter's nervous system instantly fires the corresponding hook or uppercut without conscious thought.
But wait. If every single fighter in the D'Amato gym is drilling the exact same minimalist system of 7 punches, how does anyone become a unique champion?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. Like, how do you avoid becoming completely predictable? This is where the genius of the plus one comes into play. The book describes the plus one as the fighter's carte de visite, their calling card.
Because D'Amato understood that a rigid system fails if it ignores the individual. The 7 punches were the universal foundation, but he engineered one highly customized, unique technical element for every single fighter he trained.
Yell that.
This plus one was built entirely around their specific physical anatomy and their personal psychology.
The historical examples in the book are incredible, too. Mike Tyson's plus one was this terrifying strike delivered from upside down while his feet straightened out that iconic leaping uppercut that looked like a video game move.
Oh, yeah, devastating.
And Floyd Patterson's plus one was a massive side punch delivered mid-leap, utilizing his incredible leg spring. Muhammad Ali, who actually consulted frequently with D'Amato, developed a signature move of turning his shoulders and straightening his hands to physically bar enemies from approaching his airspace.
Each of those moves was a devastating personalized weapon designed to guarantee a knockout.
I found myself questioning the strategy here, though. Let's say you're Mike Tyson. Every trainer in the world knows you have that lethal leaping uppercut. Aren't you tipping your hand?
How so?
Well, if your plus one is world famous, won't your opponents spend their entire training camp practicing how to block that specific punch?
They absolutely will. And D'Amato was counting on it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is where the physical mechanics cross over into pure psychological warfare. The plus one isn't just a punch, it's a cognitive trap.
Because the opponent is terrified of it.
They are completely consumed by it. They've watched the tape. They've seen men carried out on stretchers because of that single strike. So when they step under the bright lights, their brain is dedicating massive amounts of processing power to scanning for that specific leaping uppercut.
Ah, they're hyperfixating on the anomaly. I see where this is going.
Yep.
Because they're so incredibly paranoid about the plus one, their mental bandwidth is completely maxed out. They lose track of the fundamentals, leaving them wide open to the endless rapid-fire combinations of the standard 7 punches.
Exactly.
You just chew their defense to pieces with basic hooks and straight rights because they're too busy waiting for the monster to appear.
And then the opponent realizes they're getting battered by the standard combinations. Human instinct takes over, and they instinctively drop their guard to deal with the immediate pain of the 7 punches.
Right.
They forget about the plus one for just a fraction of a second to block a standard hook. And the moment their attention shifts, boom, the signature strike lands.
Man, it's an unsolvable dilemma. If they watch for the plus one, the combinations destroy them. If they defend the combinations, the plus one puts them to sleep. You catch them between two fires, forcing them into a state of cognitive overload until they inevitably make a mistake.
But, you know, understanding the stance, the pendulum, and the 7+1 system on paper is one thing. Teaching a human being to execute this while another human being is trying to render them unconscious requires a complete rewiring of the nervous system.
Oh, absolutely.
The book details a rigorous, unskippable sequence of training stages to achieve this.
It starts with stage 1, using what they call boxing paws, which are essentially focus pads. Now, if you watch boxing training on social media today, it's all about fighters smashing the pads as violently as possible to make loud, impressive snapping sounds.
It looks great on camera.
Right. But Tom Patty notes that in this system, the pads are treated like a cult. Fighters are specifically instructed not to hit them with knockout force.
The pads are not for power conditioning. They are purely for spatial calibration and tactical understanding. This stage is where fighters memorize the three fundamental distances of combat.
Okay, what are those?
Jabs manage long range, hooks control mid range, and uppercuts dominate close range. The pad work forces the fighter to seamlessly transition between those ranges, stringing the seven punches together based purely on spatial awareness.
Once that internal targeting system is calibrated, they move to stage two, the willy bag. The origin story of this piece of equipment is fascinating because D'Amato didn't look at other boxing gyms for inspiration.
He looked everywhere else.
Yeah. He spent 4 years analyzing piano players, trying to understand how they could strike dozens of keys per second without ever looking down at their hands. He studied marksmen who could hit moving targets without aiming down the sights. He was obsessed with the concept of unconscious competence.
He needed his fighters to throw combinations the way a pianist plays a chord. So he invented the willy bag, essentially a series of mattresses wrapped around a central pivot, marked with highly specific numbered strike points.
So you aren't just standing there hitting a heavy bag to build a sweat. This is about pure tactical footwork.
Right.
The fighter uses the twist, the pendulum, and the Spanish angles to move around the mattresses, hitting the numbered points instantly on command. It bridges the gap between knowing the seven punches intellectually and throwing them instinctively from any geographic angle.
Which perfectly primes the nervous system for stage three, and this is arguably the most brilliant and counterintuitive part of the entire methodology, slow sparring.
This detail stopped me in my tracks. Sparring in this phase is conducted at exactly one-third speed and one-third power. Why on earth would you practice fighting in slow motion? Like, how does that prepare you for the violent reality of a real fight?
Well, fighting at full speed injects adrenaline and fear into the bloodstream. When a human being panics, their brain abandons higher-level thinking and reverts to base survival instincts.
Like leaning straight back to avoid a punch.
Exactly, which we already established is fatal. Slow sparring keeps the heart rate down. It is an intensely intellectual exercise.
The text highlights an uneven rhythm used during this stage. They spar slowly for 30 seconds, and then they completely stop. The coach steps in, they analyze the geometry of what just happened, correct any biomechanical errors, and then resume for 1 minute of slow sparring before stopping to analyze again.
It is real-time debugging of the human nervous system. You completely eliminate the panic response from the learning environment. The fighter learns to see a punch coming, analyze the angle, select the correct pendulum evasion, load the weight, and fire the appropriate counterstrike without fear clouding their judgment.
It reminds me of learning a highly complex piece of music.
Yeah.
You don't just sit down at a grand piano and start smashing the keys at 120 beats per minute.
Right, it would sound terrible.
You start by slowly learning the notes, which is exactly what the pad work is.
Mm-hmm.
Then you practice your scales endlessly to build that blind muscle memory that's the willy bag. Then you play the entire song at a painfully slow tempo, stopping measure by measure to fix your finger placement, which is the slow sparring.
And only after you can play the entire composition flawlessly at a slow tempo do you finally add the passion, the speed, and the volume.
Exactly. Which brings us to stages four and five, the heavy bags and the swinging bags.
Only after the fighter's tactical movement is completely unconscious do they unleash full power. They attack the heavy bag to condition their bones and muscles for actual knockout force. Then they introduce the swinging bag, a moving, unpredictable target to train penetrating power.
What?
It teaches the fighter how to drive kinetic energy completely through a target that is trying to evade them. Once that final stage is complete, they go right back to stage one with the focus pads, continually refining the machine.
So bringing all of this together, what does Chapter 8 of Non-Compromised Pendulum really teach us? When you look at the strict rules of the stance, the loading mechanism of the pendulum, and the psychological trap of the 7+1 matrix, it proves D'Amato's central thesis, attack and defense, are not two different things.
They are one and the same.
By refusing to retreat, utilizing Spanish angles to slip into blind spots, and constantly loading that kinetic spring, a fighter dictates the total reality of the space they share with their opponent. You just become an unsolvable puzzle.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want you to take a concept from the ring and apply it to your own life. Think deeply about the plus one strategy. That highly customized, utterly unique technical element built perfectly around a fighter's specific physical and psychological strength.
It's such a powerful concept.
It really is. It served as their ultimate weapon, but its true genius was how it served as the ultimate distraction, forcing the world to fixate on the anomaly while their fundamental skills quietly dismantled the opposition. So look at your own career, your creative projects, or the way you solve problems daily. What is your plus one? What is that specific, unique advantage or perspective that belongs entirely to you? Are you minimizing it, trying to fit in with the standard combinations everyone else is using? Or are you building your entire tactical approach around it, leaning into your unique geometry to make yourself unpredictable, undeniable, and impossible to defeat?
Because whether you are navigating the chaotic angles of a boxing ring or the complexities of your own ambitions, remember this, you are at your most dangerous when your defense and your attack become the exact same movement. Thanks for diving deep with us.